This is Why Lives. I'm Mary Brophy. Coming up on today's episode, I'll be hearing about a deadly invader, one of the most dangerous threats to our native woodlands. But first, I'm in Glenveagh National Park, on the trail of its most iconic wild creature, the red deer, with District Conservation Officer Pat Vaughan.
You might see them up here at the stocking hut. That's on the Derry Beg Bog there, you know, just below the waterfall. So there's a possibility that we might see some animals congregating there, you know.
On a cold night, like last night, they would come down then in the morning to graze.
Oh yes, I mean, from any animal's perspective, you know, the farther up the mountains you go, the cooler it is. So once the frost sets in, that you know, at this time of year, the animals will certainly make their way down to the lowlands and into the woodlands where there's shelter away from the biting cold, you know.
Yeah.
And funny in a way, with the change in the colour of the purple moorgrass to this sort of a rusty brown autumny colour, if you like, the deer are pretty much exactly the same colour and they're difficult to see. Whereas during the summertime, when the purple moorgrass is green, the place is just a lush green, the animals still maintain that sort of a summer light coat and they're very easy to pick out, you know.
Yeah.
Despite what people think, you know, I mean, deer just don't wander all over the place willy-nilly, sort of grazing everything. They just don't do that. Some of the older hinds, what they call the lead hinds, who've been around for a number of years, know exactly where the best grazing, the best vegetation is, and they will in turn lead the family groups to those locations, you know. Mm.
And will, I mean, how big is the herd here?
Well, at this moment in time, based on the last count, it's 400 or thereabouts.
And will they all travel together, that 400?
Oh, not at all. I mean, they're in different family groups, and they spread out all over the park. There are times you could see anything up to maybe 60 or 70 animals in a large group. Then other times it could be four or five animals, or just a family party of three or four, you know. Just a wee quick look up here now, and if we don't see any animals, we'll take a run around to where you.
Pat, we're here at the top of the Glenveagh, the valley here, just looking right down across onto the lake and the river running here beside us. It's the russet brown of the landscape at this time of the year. It's perfect camouflage for the red deer, isn't it?
Well, there's no doubt about that, you know, and it changes with the seasons. Animals are much easier to see during the summertime, but no, you're quite right. With the purple moorgrass now having turned this sort of rusty brown colour, perfect camouflage for the hinds and the stags, you know.
Tell me about the red deer species in Ireland.
Well, what do you call these? In Glenveagh National Park, I mean, it was the wife of John George Adair. She set about establishing a park for hunting. In around about 1891, she introduced what we now know to be Scottish red deer to the park. And she also erected a deer fence to contain those animals, a deer fence that's some 6 feet high and some 25 odd miles from start to finish.
The deer herd here was introduced from Scotland as part of the Adair's plan to turn Glenveagh into a grand hunting estate. The Irish red deer is believed to have roamed this island for over 10,000 years, but overhunting and losing their habitat to man meant that many populations went extinct.
The red deer are our largest mammal. They are protected under the 1976 Wildlife Act. And the only native species that two native species that we know of at this moment in time are the Kerry red deer. They go back to the Ice Age. They're the last remnants of what people deem to be the true Irish red deer. I mean, during the famine years, these animals would have been sort of hunted to extinction.
Did deforestation have an impact on them?
Absolutely. I mean, a change in the landscape, and obviously the landscape has changed over the millennia, you know, in terms of natural woodland. The habitat and what they'd have been used to and the shelter that they would have obtained from that would have brought about a dare say a reduction in the population.
We head on, and one of our first sightings is a lone majestic stag.
Look out here, just see behind behind the tree. Put one animal behind on Scotch pine tree.
Oh yeah.
Let's go back. Looks like a stag now. So it is, yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Now he's there on his own.
He's there on his own. No, and even at that distance there, and I don't have, let me see my binoculars. He's a young stag, a couple of years old. You can see even he's got a fairly large mane on his neck there, you know. He's dark in colour.
He looks healthy.
Oh, he's in top notch. Yeah, and that animal now is probably about 160 yards away. Absolutely motionless. If we were up one of them now and he got our scent, well then, I mean, he would be gone, you know. It's one thing that they're more tolerant for humans that are close to them anyway, you know. But that's the sort of animal there now that we would consider, you know, for culling purposes, you know.
And why would he be the right age?
Well, I mean, apart from right age, there's large numbers of those within the park. But if you're to control the population of deer, culling stags has little or no impact on the population at all. You've got to remove the breeding animals, which are the hinds. You reduce the females, thereby reducing productivity and in turn reducing the numbers of animals.
Mm.
But of course, we can't leave the place to be overrun by stags either. So it's a combination of the end result.
So this is a young.
That's a young
stag.
That there will be described to most hunters as a pricket.
Yeah.
She's just got two little straight antlers.
Yeah.
Coming 2 years old, and it's just ideal for taking out because there's lots of those within the park, you know.
Mm-mm.
Lots of those in the park.
And he's gone back to grazing there, he says.
He's quite content there, you see, because he's under no pressure in here, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, if that animal now, you know, had been shot at before and missed like I say, you were upwind of it, I mean, it wouldn't hang about there at all. Let's see if we can see some hinds farther up the glen.
It's a wild herd at this point in terms of Glenveagh. What's the numbers?
Last year's count is around about 400 animals.
Mm. And why do you count them?
Well, to establish population and to establish what the cull needs to be for the coming year. And based on that ballpark figure, we can make then a fairly good guess at the number of animals that need to be removed in order to allow regeneration to take place and to provide sort of reasonable cover and good quality grazing for the animals that remain. Two heads here in the skyline, yeah. That's two hinds. Or how could we hind a calf now at that distance? Right on the edge of the rocks there, yeah.
Yeah, I see them. Just watching us from the top. And they would have been down here...
Last night,
yeah. And they're right up to there
right
now.
Up on the top because it's mild enough. And even the seeing of that there now, they're not up there because of us. They're up there now because it's mild.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And they choose to be there.
Yeah.
I mean, if that was bitterly cold and there were snow, you can rest assured they'll be down here somewhere on the slopes of the... At this distance here, it's a hind probably in last year's calf. Yeah, it looks like it. Yeah, definitely a hind, all right, yeah. And it's our calf, yeah. They stay in family groups, you know, for two or three generations, you know. As well as selecting the animal, I would actually select the geographical location in such a way that it's useful for the eagles to feed on the carcass, you know. And along with that, too, I mean, you can't shoot a carcass where there's a possibility, or even a remote possibility, of somebody's going to walk hell walking, going to just come upon it, you know. I just don't understand.
Talk of culling these beautiful animals may sound cruel, but the national parks exist to conserve both animal and plant species. Pat and his team have an obligation to maintain the balance as they've inherited it here at Glenveagh. And as the red deer no longer has a natural predator to control the numbers, if culling doesn't take place, both Glenveagh's vegetation and the deer suffer.
It's all about creating the degree of equilibrium by between the animal and the landscape that they're living on. I mean, beyond no illusion, I mean, animals migrate into the park and they move out of the park. We try and keep those numbers at a level that has been sort of proven to help regeneration in the woodlands and improve the quality of the animals themselves.
But I wasn't convinced that the woodland in Glenveagh is getting a fair chance to regenerate. When we look at it now, there are no trees. There are very few trees left.
Yeah.
How do the deer help that? I mean, you know, that they're constantly grazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, one would have to say that the deer are not an ideal grazer from a landscape management point of view. Having said that, in terms of some of the dense woodlands, the small dense woodlands within the park, it's also useful that the occasional deer, not all of them, but the occasional deer, sort of make their way through these woodlands, and in turn they keep the woodlands open.
It must be quite a challenging job.
It is a challenge. I mean, it's always a challenge, you know, but by and large, I mean, if you look at the landscape, look at landscapes per se, I mean, they haven't changed an awful lot in hundreds of years anyway. And it is a challenge to maintain what we've inherited in its current state. But we do that in a number of ways, and one of the ways is managing the deer herd, which is a small part of it. The other way is by carrying out various programs within the park in terms of creating exclosures and enclosures, if you like, in order to keep animals exclusively away from areas whereby we can allow just nature to do its very own thing. And it's all a balancing act. I mean, if we weren't here at all, or we weren't involved in any form of management here, I have no doubt that the landscape in the uplands would change. In terms of even domestic stock grazing in the uplands, if they were all removed, well, I have absolutely no doubt that the reason that certain landscapes were selected as being of SAC quality would ultimately change.
Would that be a bad thing? I mean, just to see what nature does, that could be some inheritance for our children into the future.
Absolutely. Well, that's a moving feast, and there's a variety of opinion in relation to what are we actually trying to achieve, and it's not an easy question to answer, you know. But given the what we're faced with in the context of the national park, although we're doing what we can do to maintain the status quo within the national park, who are we to ultimately decide whether or not we change that?
For nature conservation, that's a really interesting question, maybe even radical. But here's another one. What happens to an ecosystem under threat if we don't intervene? You're listening to Wild Lives. I'm Mary Brophy. Well, earlier in this episode, I was talking with Pat Vaughan about the possible merits of not maintaining a status quo here in Glenveagh. But what happens if that ecosystem is invaded by a species with no natural predators, a species that threatens to destroy everything in its path? Rhododendron ponticum is one such plant. Introduced to Ireland in the 18th century as an ornamental, this evergreen shrub with its large pink flowers devastates native ecosystems. It smothers and poisons woodlands by forming an impenetrable thicket, and it harbours a fungus that kills a number of trees. It was planted here in Glenveagh in the Castle Gardens in 1888, and it was soon out of control, spreading throughout the estate. Ranger Robbie Miller has been involved in the rhododendron eradication programme for years.
If you can see, if you look in the slope there, it's a good place to get an overview of the scale of the rhododendron problem. So if you look over there, you see all the dead, sprayed bushes.
Yeah, it looks kind of scarred.
Yeah. Part of the next phase after the rhododendron control and eradication is to try and get the woodland canopy back again, because we're really just left with, as you can see, like a complete bare slope. So as soon as we get that reforested, the better. And you see there's a lot of cliffs here as well. And a big problem with the rhododendron, if you look through the binoculars here, you'll see there's still some bushes that are way up in the cliffs. I don't know if you can see them there, Mary. You'll see.
Oh, I do, yeah.
See, everything else dies back this time of year,
And they don't.
They're kind of the only things left that look as if they have any life on them, you know. Yeah. So basically everything else is switched off, except for them.
They're maintaining themselves in little, what looks like relative isolation. Like there's a couple of them there just in pockets.
we would only have to leave a few bushes up on the cliffs, and if we come back again in 20 years, it would be back to butt.
As Robbie drives me through recently cleared areas, he paints a stark picture of what the infestation was like.
This is the main bulk of the Atlantic oak woodland. And as I was saying earlier on, you know, when you were driving up here, it would be basically, there would be nothing except rhododendron, you know, bushes on either side. So if you can imagine starting here, we're at the roadside, and, you know, walking up to the top of the hill, it would have been in complete darkness, yes. You know, between 10 and 15 feet high. So you end up with an absolute wipeout of the biodiversity, you know. So once where there was before a rich blanket of lush green and all the different colours of green and all the insects and wildlife associated with the oak woodlands, you know, you get you really do get a complete wipeout, you know. And an oak tree, the life cycle on average about 200 years, so they don't get to complete the life cycle. So if you leave that to its sort of natural conclusion, even the trees themselves will die out, because they won't get to regenerate and the darkness. So it really is an ecological nightmare. We're here just at the castle, you know, and if you look up the glen, you can see the bulk of the woodland just running along the shoreline here. And it kind of finishes just beyond, you know, the top of the Loch Fay there. And, you know, as woodland goes, it's quite scarce in Ireland. Mm. I think somebody said one time that Ireland's the most treeless place in Europe, and Donegal's probably the most treeless place in Ireland, you know. So it really is getting to be a scarce thing. If you look through the trees there, you'll see another deer fence. That's the Mullingore exclosure. I think it's roughly about 20 hectares. That runs right up to the top of the hill, and it's probably the nicest wee pocket of woodland within the park. That's one of my favourite places, actually, you know. We might even take a wander in. We call it Glen Lack, and it's just one of the most beautiful wee undiscovered magical glens. It's just so beautiful standing here, you know, as I was saying, it's one of my favourite places, just looking at the sun shining through the trees and a beautiful autumn day, you know. This place here, Glen Lack, you know, you can hear the stream cascading down, you know. It's like a wee wooded gorge, and it really is one of the most remote, special places I know in any time in Donegal or Ireland. It's just such a beautiful place, and we'll go in there and have a wee look.
Robbie also recruited teams of volunteers and students to help with this mammoth and often dispiriting task.
I did supervise volunteers, and we had park staff, you know. So basically you'd have bushes as thick as your leg, sometimes thicker, and we'd be cutting them back with chainsaws, and we'd have students, you know, pulling them back in a line and you know, burning them, because the amount of bio, like, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen a rhododendron thicket, but it's just so entangled, you know. And when you get up on a Monday morning and you're looking into that, it really is soul destroying, because it's even to get one branch out of the entanglement, you know, and there's just so much of it. So we had to burn it, you know, to create some
to space.
In the early 90s, we tried all different things, you know. We tried organic control techniques, you know, ring barking, various different methods, and at the end of the day, there was no alternative to use except for using chemicals. So basically glyphosate or Roundup, most gardeners will be familiar with it. I used to say to volunteers, you know, when they were coming, you know, just imagine what it's going to be like when you feel the wind blowing through the trees. This is one of the oak trees.
And this was covered
Yeah, this was I remember working in here with students back in the early 90s, you know, and it was just literally black. You know, there was nothing growing at all. And now you see this lovely carpet of green and, you know, all the regeneration, particularly holly. There's loads of holly coming up. Lots of these mosses, and there was a survey done in 1990. They found that, you know, Donegal had the cleanest air in Europe. You know, so when you're here, take a good lungful of that, you know, lovely clean mountain air.
All around us here, Robbie, you're right. It is a carpet of green. That moss is just gorgeous, and the leaves after falling from the trees, the brown in between them, like confetti.
Yeah,
it's fabulous. And is it under control here, do you think?
Well, you know, that's always a big question about it. You know, it's really difficult to control, but having been involved with it on and off in the last 22 years, and I've been to a lot of the other badly infested sites, Killarney National Park, six national parks in Ireland, you know, and Killarney, I mean, the scale of it down there is unbelievable, you know. Hundreds or thousands or millions wouldn't scrape the surface of it. It seems to be confined mostly to the west, you know, Western Ireland and the Wales and the west of Scotland, you know, where the habitats are more sort of acidic.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the heather species, so it likes the kind of acidy bog type of places. Having said all that, I think, without sounding too biased, I think we have got to grips with it more than any other place. We're starting to see development of, you know, the vegetation coming back. There are more trees coming in. You'll see a lot of sapling and seedling recruitment and establishment. Like, most of my life has been dedicated to getting this woodland back, and the rhododendron eradication is just the first stage of that. It ties into so many things. It ties into deer management, and it ties into also how do you get the trees back in again, you know. And
are you finding that they'll sort of spread along the edge of the lake? They seem to be coming out there in little pockets, but not up at the top, just along the edge.
Well, I don't know if you can see it from here, Mary, but there's a fence line just running along the bottom.
The fence is
and
the
it kind of goes in a wedge.
Right.
But you see the way the trees have sort of colonised within that wee wedge.
Yeah.
And you don't really get them much outside it.
As I walked in Glenlack with Robbie, I had an almost palpable sense of this wood coming back to life. The rhododendron's choking grip has been released, and these beautiful trees can breathe again.
And it's great walking into these places now, you know, just to feel that, you know, space and light and wind getting in, you know. You really do get the feeling that it's the beginning of, you know, the regeneration.
Well, that's it for today. Join me next week for the final episode in this series, when I'll be visiting one of Ireland's most important nature reserves. And I end my wild journey in South Donegal on the beautiful peninsula of St. John's Point. Wild Lives is produced and edited by Neil Boyle. It is a Hollybrook production for Highland Radio, funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland, with the television licence fee.